Okay, here we are back again for part four. We'll try and keep this quick. Just the final fraud one that I wanted to talk about was Diederik Stapel, who there was a long article about him in the New York Times, I think, and he was a social psychologist in the Netherlands. And I think his story is interesting because it shows us both the pressure that is on people to produce novel and significant results, and the rewards that they get for producing novel and significant results, and the relative weakness of the controls on this. Stapel was a social psychologist, and he did experiments in social psychology. Now, I don't know very much about this, but generally experiments in social psychology come up and say, yeah, there is this effect, you know, so that, you know, I might have an effect which says that, you know, if I'm sitting here talking and the two of you are nodding at me and smiling, I'll continue talking. Whereas if you have sour faces and begin shaking your heads, I will dry out. So yeah. that would be in a social psychology experiment, just off the top of my head. And you can have these things, but generally they show really kind of mingy results. You know, that you say, yeah, that happens to about 0.5% of the time.
So you look at you look at pictures of supermodels, and then you rate yourself against those supermodels, and you can, you know, on the whatever scale, and theoretically you're supposed to rate yourself less because you've been looking at pictures of supermodels.
Okay. Yeah, we've both given people way too much insight into our minds, Amanda. Both of us, so yes.
This is what this guy was doing. It was about attracting them. Anyway.
This is going to go viral. But would have done if you'd mentioned that guy's name. It would go viral if sue us. But they won't. Not if they know what's good for them. But Stapel sent, he was sending articles off to journals saying, I found this small effect, and the peer reviews were saying, that's a small effect. So he found that, he realised that he was the only person who knew that it had been a small effect, and he had been honestly reporting this. So he began kind of tipping the scales a bit and reporting a larger effect than he had found. And then he found that he was able to get into better and better journals. And the more, and when we say better journals, we mean more highly cited journals. Mm-hmm. So going back to that, because people cite what appear to be really significant results. So he began fudging the figures a bit.
Yeah. What was even more disreputable, though, is that he was actually using students' work. So he was, apparently, this is what they said, that the students were really just surprised that he wanted to conduct the experiments, even though it was their thesis, and he was kind of co-authoring.
Yeah. He got himself into quite a bad way. He through this, and this is how the system works, he then attracted a number of PhD students. Right. And then he found that if you're making up the data or fudging the data, you don't actually need to do the study. so then I tell you, it is funny. So then he realised that it was a bit of a waste of time running around kind of observing people and so on, and working out whether people nodding caused other people to keep talking, or whether looking sceptically caused them to dry up and so on. You know, that takes a lot of time, and it's really quite boring. So if you just sort of make it up, and he began literally doing that, he began faking it. So the famous one where, which he did, and I won't go into it, but he did it in a bus terminus. The bus terminus didn't actually exist.
It did, but the layout was very different.
The layout was very different. Anyway, he began doing this, and then he had a pool of PhD students, which you have if you're a good researcher. So he began, and this is what Amanda was referring to, giving them, he just gave them data.
Right.
And so they were, this thing gets into serious misbehaviour, because the student's supposed to carry out the study. But they couldn't really do that because there wasn't any study.
Yes.
And secondly, if they had carried out studies, they would have got miserable results, such as the ones he'd got. So he had PhD students who were getting good doctorates, producing really interesting discoveries in the field of social psychology, and people were citing this, and he was opening up new areas of study. And there were doubters around him. There were people thinking, how does he do this? And, you know, where is the bus terminus, as you say, that looks like the one that he's describing, and when did he do the study, and so on. But, you know, by this stage he was, you know, head of department, he had control over money and so on. And
yes, I think he actually used the phrase here, the cookie jar was on the table without a lid.
Yeah.
It became, cumulative.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, back to the point that you made about there's no controls, or very few controls. It was really only his students that kind of noticed that, you know, lines of data were very ridiculously similar.
Yeah, that's right. And that's actually what happened. And just go back to the fact that the peer reviewers take stuff on trust. There's no lid on the cookie jar.
Yes.
It's a while since I read the article, but we'll put a link to the article, because it is an interesting read. Anyway, so it took one of his, or two of his students, was it, they noticed that they were both studying different things, but they both had the same line of data in their spreadsheet. And he had been kind of sitting up at night faking it, and it's actually quite hard work faking data. And one of the amusing things his wife said, well, he did seem to work very late at night. So they discovered this and realised he's just making all this up. And other people around the place knew, but it took quite a bit of courage on their part to actually call him on it. And you know, eventually he admitted it, which really had very serious results, one of which is some of these silly ideas, exaggerated ideas, were out there. You're looking sceptically at me, but I'll continue talking. No, you're not really. One of which the ideas were out there. Secondly, that it really cast doubt on all those people who got doctorates.
Yes.
So nasty, nasty. And there were very few controls to stop him from doing it, and quite considerable rewards. You know, the only risk that he took, the same risk that Robert Maxwell took, if you get caught doing bad stuff, you know, then that has a really bad outcome.
Yes.
Right. Which I suppose is why you have more than one supervisor.
Yeah, there's that too, you know. But if he's head of department, you know, got a lot of prestige, you know. So anyway, it's all in the New York Times article. So that's it, I think.
The important thing is that if we did have access to open data, these things could be checked right from the get-go.
Yep. Mm. Yeah, well, that's right. Open data is, again, another really complex issue. But the point is, nobody had seen the data but the students. So he was able to publish articles with graphs and so on, and really everyone had to take the data just at face value.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
I don't have anything.
You don't have anything?
I don't have anything.
I don't have anything. Do you have anything, Catherine?
No, what's happening next time?
Should we talk about open access sometime? Yeah, let's do green open access.
We'll do green open access next time?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
Good idea.
Great.
And we will now have all this background, so we'll be able to talk about all this stuff and everyone will know what we mean. Okay. Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, if you have been. Thank you.